war. It's fantastic.
Christopher Media, let's make some noise.
Hey folks, it's your host Mike White. I'm sure that by now you have heard that actor Miguel Ferrer has passed away, and it's kind of a devastating blow. Mr. Ferrer had given us a tremendous, tremendous interview for the RoboCop episode, one of the earliest episodes of the projection booth to ever go out, and he was just terrific to talk to. I was so surprised that he gave us the time and that he gave so much of it. He was really just a wonderful interview. So I've been sitting on some extra interview with him for the longest time. I don't know why I haven't put it out, but I suppose now is the best time to do so, so that folks can remember Miguel Ferrer as the completely hilarious, great raconteur, just wonderful guy that he was. So thank you very much, Mr. Ferrer. I'm so glad that you were on the show, and I hope that folks remember you well, because you are one heck of a guy.
You know, starting out as a drummer, you must have had, you came up, so you probably were, you were influenced, I'm sure, by like John Bonham and like Buddy Miles maybe. And then, but did you ever go back and listen to like the Gene Krupa stuff?
Yeah, I mean, not much Krupa, but a lot of Buddy Rich.
Yeah, okay.
And an awful lot of other jazz guys. That was my training, you know. I wanted to play drums when I was a kid, much to my father's horror. He wanted me to play piano the way he did, because, you know, he didn't really consider a drummer a real musician unless you were playing on the level of a Buddy Rich or a Max Roach or someone like that. So he said, all right, I'll let you play drums, but you must study. You have to learn to sight read. And as soon as you take it less than absolutely seriously, then I'm taking the drums away and it's over. So from the age of 8 till I'd say about 14 or 15, I studied very hard once a week, and as a result was, you know, pretty employable by the time I was in my teens. And was able to play a lot of different styles that most guys my age could not, which is, you know, pretty much the reason that the way that I found my way into the Bing Crosby group. I was able to play jazz and read music and able to swing a big band and do all that stuff. I totally forget the beginning of your question. What did you say?
Oh, that was just a leading question. I was just trying to pull from you who your influences were.
Yeah, you know, that's right, yeah. I mean, Buddy Rich could do the impossible. He was, and still remains, in my opinion, the greatest who ever lived, which is not to say that I didn't greatly admire John Bonham and all those guys, and certainly Keith, and, you know, great rock drummers. I love those guys, but, you know, there was no one like Buddy Rich. And Buddy Rich and Gene Krupa were actually very good friends, and they had some very well-publicized drum wars, which is what they called them back then. They'd play with the band, and then one would take a solo, and the other would take a solo, and the other would take a solo, and they'd try to top each other. And Buddy Rich had such great respect for Gene Krupa that he never, ever, ever embarrassed him. And he never buried him in one of these things, which he could have done with a hand tied behind his back. But he loved Gene Krupa and loved the fact that he opened the door to quote-unquote star drummers. He really legitimized drummers for the first time in a way that they hadn't been previously. And as a result, he, you know, just showed a great deal of respect and restraint in those encounters, you know, because he really could have embarrassed the old man, but he never did.
So I'm going to go completely away from the drumming stuff. I just had one question I had to ask you. I think
I've gone completely away from it too, so you might as well.
I think I'm one of the few people in the United States that have seen a movie that you did for television called L.A. Sheriff's Homicide.
Oh, yeah.
And I was
You don't know how hard I had to. I had to get a guy in Belgium to tape that off of their cable system to see it.
I've never seen it. I'd love to see it.
Well, yeah. If you want, I'll hook you up with a copy.
If you could burn me a DVD, I'd be eternally grateful, because I'd love to see that. It was written by James Ellroy, as you probably know, who is, I think, was one of the greatest American writers alive. And it was a brilliant screenplay and just no punches pulled whatsoever. And I was really happy to be a part of that. The script was ordered by the head of NBC at the time. It was a guy named, oh God, this is just so embarrassing. I can't remember his name. Anyway, between the time that the script was ordered and the pilot was delivered, he had been relieved of his duties by a guy named Scott Sassa, who was an Asian American. And as you recall, having seen the pilot, the victims in that particular case were Asians. And, you know, in the cop vernacular, in a very realistic fashion, they were referred to regularly as slopes and slants and japs and chinks and things like that, just the way cops talk. And Scott Sassa took great umbrage at that depiction of Asian people and said, there's no way in hell I'm making this thing. There's not a chance. I don't care who wrote it. I don't care who's in it. I don't care how good it is. It's a racist piece of shit, and I want nothing to do with it. Well, Paramount Television tap danced and said, all right, listen, we've got this thing. We believe in it. What if we reshot the pilot, leaving out some of the harder edges? And Scott Sassa said, all right. And so this is the only time I've ever heard of this done. A year later, we reshot the entire pilot. It wasn't a 2-hour, it was a 1-hour. They rewrote it, recast it, changed every cast member with the exception of myself, and shot a softer, friendlier version of it, which never made it to air. It actually had a time slot. They were going to do it, and in the 11th hour it was pulled, which is unfortunate because I think Sheriff's Homicide is an area of law enforcement that has been completely overlooked, and it's a very specific, unusual homicide details, unlike robbery homicide in LAPD or any other law enforcement entity I can think of, for a lot of reasons that I won't go into now because I don't want to bore your audience. But it was a real inside look into a police organization that I think very few people know anything about.
Right. Yeah. And it's one of those things that Ellroy frequently, you know, he usually positions the LA Sheriff's Office versus the LAPD. And that's always a great source of conflict.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. And I think it remains so. I think Ellroy really got to know the Sheriff's Department intimately. I don't know how familiar you are with his work, but in his memoir, My Dark Places, when he really got to know about the murder of his mother, he hired a retired sheriff's homicide investigator with his own money, and they spent a year and a half reinvestigating his mother's murder. And I think he learned everything he knows about the sheriff's department and the in general, and in particular the inner workings of the homicide bureau from that experience.
Yeah, isn't that's a great book, isn't it? It's so good.
It's phenomenal. I just think it's one of the giants of modern American literature. I really do. And he confronted it with such honesty that I can't think of too many more parallels of compelling reading. I still remember the first line from that book. And that first line was, some kids found her.
Yeah, yeah. So before we leave David Lynchland, can you talk a little bit about On the Air? Because I feel like that was something that was so far ahead of its time as well.
Did you see any of them?
Yeah, I own them.
Yeah.
I think it's I think it's difficult to be objective when you're a David Lynch fan because you love every single thing he puts his mark on.
Again, it was something that was so far afield from anything any the television viewer had ever seen.
I think it would do great if it was on the air today versus, 20 years ago, maybe.
Yeah, it was well ahead of its time. To call it a parody would be, calling the hydrogen bomb an explosion. It was just so out there. The hurry up twins with three legs and the blind sound man and was he the sound man who was blind? Is that what it was?
I think so.
I think so too. But the network, there's a big network note where it said, you can't have a blind guy. It's going to alienate too much of the audience. It can't be a blind guy. So David Lynch, doing a lot of research, found some little known visual impairment. And I think it ran with a subtitle saying, so-and-so suffers from such-and-such, which causes things to float before his eyes, which aren't really there. So that wasn't the original concept. He was initially meant to be a blind sound man, but it was tweaked as a network note.
Yeah, it would have been better if it was a deaf sound man.
I know. Believe me, something tells me that was David's first impulse.
Oh, sorry about that, guys. I cut out. Switching gears again. I mean, you've been in such an eclectic array of films, and some of my favorites, believe it or not, like Project Elf. I actually really like that movie a lot. And I'm a big fan.
Project Elf is what we refer to as a money gig. I turned that thing down about five times. Come on, are you serious? Act of the Puppet, come on, give me a break. And they kept upping the salary to a point where I just said, all right, I don't want the career to peak too soon. Let's do it.
Nice. How did you, Mike, go ahead. Did you have more?
Oh, yeah. I also wanted to ask you, I'm sorry, I feel like such a fanboy when I'm just like throwing out titles and looking for funny stories. But this one, a little more serious. I'm a big fan of The Harvest. I really like that one a lot, too.
You know, I'm so happy you saw that because I'm really proud of that picture. I think it was a really good picture, and it's unfortunate what happened to it. I think the distribution company that was all lined up went out of business at the last minute, and they had to kind of hustle it out on a secondary, shunt it to a secondary company, and it never really had a chance at any meaningful distribution or any support whatsoever. But I'm really proud of that little movie, and I think there were some wonderful performances and a good script and a terrific job from a first-time director. And I really worked hard on it, and I'm still proud of that picture to this day. Only despite the fact that you and I are probably make up the vast majority of people who've seen it.
Yeah, I was very lucky. I was working at a video store at the time, and I saw that come in, and I was like, "This sounds really good," and it didn't disappoint.
Oh, I'm glad.
So
glad to hear you say that.
So going on, because it's really interesting, because we can just sit here and go through your filmography and pick up really awesome, awesome work that you've done. Like, so, and I totally forget that you actually did that short film with Paul Thomas Anderson right after that. How did you, he was really young at that when he did that. So how did you get connected with that?
Oh, God. I'll try to make this story as quickly as possible. I don't know if you know, but Paul's father...
Yeah, it's Goulardi.
Ernie Anderson was the guy at ABC, the voice.
The Love Boat dad, yeah.
The Love Boat guy. And I sort of had a little sideline as a voiceover guy at the time. And I was going down the elevator with my voiceover agent and this man, and she was cursing under her breath, looking at her watch, and I said, "What's the matter?" And she said, "Well, I got to get this." Oh no! It wasn't this 14-year-old kid, and this agent. She goes, "What's wrong?" She goes, "Well, I got to get this kid to Studio City, and I'm doing Marina Del Rey for a fundraiser. I'm not going to make it." And I said, "Well, I live in Studio City. I'll take him." He said, "Really? You sure you don't mind?" I said, "No, I don't mind at all." So this 14-year-old kid gets in my car, and it turns out it was Ernie Anderson's son named Paul. And I gave him a ride, and we were chatting, and we just talked about stuff. And I dropped him off at his dad's house, and that was sort of the end of it. And he called me several years later, and he said, "I don't know if you remember me, but you gave me a ride home one time, and I'm making this little movie, and is there any way in the world I could convince you to give me one of your afternoons and just do this little part? It would be such a great favor." And I said, "Sure, you know, why not?" And that's how that came about. And that's the last time I talked to Paul.
Yeah, too bad you didn't get in Boogie Nights, huh?
son of a bitch. I guess I drove poorly on that ride home or something. I don't know.
Did you drink his milkshake?
What does that mean?
That's his line from "There Will Be Blood."
Oh, no. I stopped watching his movies after he didn't call me for Boogie Nights.
Right on.
Little fucker. Yeah, I was like, yeah, thanks. Well, that's also when I learned there's no such thing as a favor.
Mike, do you have another one?
Yeah, well, first I've got one compliment. You were my favorite part of Hot Shots Part 2. Your line about war being fantastic is whenever that preview came on, it was always like, yeah, here it comes. You know, it was so good.
Oh, God.
Sorry. But it was the best part of the whole film. So you carried that movie for me.
Oh, well, thank you. You know, it's one of those, that was just one of those occasions where there was absolutely no acting involved. You know, we just went to work every day and laughed our asses off. There were some really funny guys, you know, Ryan Stiles, who went on to become a big deal. And Charlie Sheen has been in the news lately, was hysterically funny.
Who's Charlie Sheen?
He's winning.
Not in Detroit. You know we're calling from Detroit, right?
What?
You know we're calling from Detroit. You're calling from Detroit, right?
I didn't know you were calling from Detroit.
Yeah.
And has his show played there?
Oh, you didn't hear it? It tanked.
Oh, yeah.
And everyone walked.
He got booed off the stage.
Yeah, half the people walked out wanting their money back.
Oh, man. I can't see. I would love to just see what the hell he does. I mean, I can't imagine. So I guess it must not have been interesting enough, because I'll tell you, that flurry of interviews that went on for about a week and a half were riveting. I don't know how you felt about them, but I couldn't get enough.
They were interesting too, because you could see the progression. You know, it's like, I don't know. There has to be some mental sickness there.
Yeah, you know, I feel bad for the guy, because he was just really nice to me and really funny and just a great guy. But yeah, he seems to be, you know, in need of something in his life. I'm not sure what that is.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons. I mean, we're big RoboCop fans already, but, you know, with them talking about putting a statue here in the city.
Yeah, what's the feeling over there about that? Well,
I'm one of the people that says, why would you put a statue here when they didn't even shoot it in Detroit? You should put
that's
it in
true.
Dallas. But
that's a good point.
Yeah,
I'm waiting for the Axel Foley statue myself.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, I see a bigger push than anyone I've seen in my lifetime to sort of, you know, rejuvenate Detroit, and I hope to God it works. I mean, it's a city that could really use it. And I don't know if you guys must be aware of it. I've never seen a PR push on behalf of the rehabilitation of a city, and I hope for everyone's sake there that it gets some traction.
It's not looking good.
Because you know I'm you're far more well aware of Detroit history than I am, but from what I understand, pre-67 it was a very vibrant community with
that is very true, very segregated but also very vibrant.
I guess we'd rather not bring that part of it up, proud home ownership was a big part of life. The unemployment rate was very low, and everybody was working and seemed to be functioning, and I guess 67 kind of changed that, and it never really covered, to my understanding.
No, it didn't.
You guys might have a different perspective, but it's just sort of what I understand.
No, it didn't.
No, it's funny that you say that there's a big PR push, because we're not actually seeing that here in the city too much.
Well, God, from what I hear from television commercials with really cool soundtracks to spokespeople such as Eminem and just word of mouth and just from talk radio and opinion pieces in newspapers, it seems to really be a groundswell of goodwill towards Detroit, and I hope it bears fruit.
Well, it's the thing is, there's just so much corruption in the government. That's basically an issue too. So a lot of people tend to focus. Yeah, they're constantly uncovering. They're still investigating the mayor, and it's been 2.5 years since he left.
Yeah. So, wow.
Well, there's a big thing about a murder. Like they killed the stripper, and it's big news.
Boy, that really makes Marion Barry look like a Boy Scout, huh?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Really. Yeah, and the one before, who was throughout the 70s, Coleman Young, he was just as dirty, but no one really kind of points fingers at him, so it's kind of strange.
Yeah, well.
But sorry, we're getting into politics now, right?
Yeah, we got to talk about the stand, because yeah. I'm a...
Well, let's just say that we could use OCP right now. That's all I'm going to say.
Little OCP, yeah, you know, right? Little new Detroit wouldn't hurt anybody.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. So, listen, The Stand was just on television yesterday, and I love The Stand to death, and in particular, I love the jailhouse scene with you. And so, how did you get involved in The Stand?
They called me up and said, you want to be a part of The Stand, and The Stand was my favorite Stephen King novel, and still is. I just thought it was, just sweeping in scope and just had incredible themes and, just an amazing...
I always think that you felt like you knew all the characters when you were done with it.
Yeah, I mean, it was a real moral... metaphor. I mean, it was just, I just think it's probably his greatest work. So I went in and met, and then I found out that he had written the script. And then I really got excited because I had known that they'd tried to develop it as a feature film for a while, but there was too much story and they couldn't figure out what to leave out. It was just too much going on for it to really serve the piece. And then when I heard it was going to be an 8-hour miniseries actually adapted by Stephen King, that's when I really got excited. And I went in and campaigned, just without embarrassment to play Randall Flagg. I really, really wanted that part. And they said no.
Yeah, because I was thinking, I was just thinking to myself, you would have been perfect for that. I don't understand why you got Lloyd, because...
Well, I couldn't agree with you more, but they said, actually, we're out to this guy named Jamie Sheridan, but would you like to play, you know, this other guy? And I said, look, the answer is yes. I'd love to do that, but I would, you know... you're not going to be able to print it, but I said, I would blow you to play Randall Flagg. It's actually, I actually said that in the meeting in front of a bunch of executives, and I'm not sure how it went over, but that's what I said. And I said, well, we're out to this guy, Jamie Sheridan, and we're not sure if he's going to take it. And if he doesn't take it, then, you know, then we'll give you some real serious consideration. And I knew Jamie for some time. We'd worked on a short-lived TV series together called Shannon's Deal. And I went home and called up Jamie, and I said, so, you know, you're going to do this thing, right? And he said, I don't know if I'm going to do it. He said, the money's not good, and I just don't get it. I don't know. It's sci-fi, and... I'm not a Stephen King fan. And I said, you know what? I said, part of me wishes you wouldn't take it, because then I'd have a real shot at it. But if you don't take it, I'm going to come over and kick your ass, because it would be the stupidest thing you'd ever done in your life. And he said, really? I said, read the book. Just read the book. And obviously he wound up taking it, and he did a fantastic job.
So you sabotaged yourself, basically.
Say again?
You sabotaged yourself.
Yeah, it's not the first time I've done that. I've been married 4 times as well. So what can I tell you? But yeah, that's one I really wanted to do, but I was happy to be a part of it. And I think, you know, my little bit as Lloyd came out all right. So
yeah, that's great.
And I really think it was overall a really good piece. I thought it was a terrific miniseries.
Yeah, it's really interesting, because like a lot of people I know either love it or you hate it. So it's really interesting that it's still got popularity after all these years too. It's like really
I just don't know how you hate it with such a great cast and just so beautifully executed. That was the first time director Mick Garris. And he took on that monumental task. We shot for 100 days, and he was never ruffled. He never lost his temper. He never lost his cool. And he turned in a beautiful piece of work, I think.
Yeah, it's amazing. And look how big he's become now, too, you know?
Yep. Makes a talented, smart guy.
So on your filmography, there's this listing from 2007, which says, Video Short, RoboCop, Villains of Old Detroit. Do you know what is this, and like why haven't we seen it? Being RoboCop fans,
that's a complete fiction. I have no idea what that is. What does it say, RoboCop? What
it says, RoboCop: Villains of Old Detroit, 2007, directed by Laurel Parker and Aaron Vanek, short film.
If it ever was made, I was not asked to be a part of it.
Maybe it was like an extra feature on a DVD or something.
Yeah,
that's what I'm thinking.
2007?
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's you, Ronnie Cox, Kurtwood Smith, and Ray Wise in it.
I might have talked to somebody about something like that. I don't know. I have no memory of that whatsoever. And believe me, there was no acting involved. I might have spoken to somebody on camera about it, but that's sitting in a chair telling stories like I am with you. But it certainly is nothing, anything near the way they make it sound.
Gotcha. So I just got a few more for you, because I know we're going a while here. So I'm a huge fan. I know Mike is a huge fan of Crossing Jordan. So how did you get involved with the show? And I noticed that you also direct an episode.
I actually directed about 6 of them, I think. I can't remember exactly, but, you know, just same old thing. It was just I was sent the script to the pilot, and I really responded to it. I thought it was now you get all kinds of stuff in the morgue carving up dead bodies, but back then there was CSI sort of examined the world of forensic pathology, but they weren't from medical examiner's point of view, so it was kind of a dark take on the police procedural that one had not seen before, and that was interesting to me. And in the pilot, the character was really in the midst of a complete nervous breakdown, and I thought that would be interesting to play. And originally, the series was intended to be somewhat mystical and just with curious miracles occurring here and there, and inexplicable events, and interspersed with this sort of dark backdrop that really elevated the whole piece. Is sort of my vocabulary is leaving me too. Just a juxtaposition in tone, and I think it completely confused the network. I think they said, "Well, why does that? There was." Why is this a story of redemption? I don't understand, when it's really a morgue and it's a crime. And so that part of the series was largely changed from the pilot and completely omitted from the series. They wanted it to be more like CSI. They wanted to really focus on the case and nothing but the case. The creators will say, all right, well, then let's focus not only on the case, because that's boring and it's been done to death. Let's focus on the personal relationships within the morgue and life within the morgue and what that's really like and what you get to take home in your head every night after you work in a morgue, and why for some people it's truly a chosen profession. Why do you go to medical school and choose to work with dead people only? Let's explain and examine all those aspects. And of course, that was shot down by the network. They said, we don't want to see any interpersonal story arcs. We want every episode to be a standalone. We don't want to know what happens with these people. We don't care about their personalities or how they contrast or interact or attract or repel, anything like that. Take all that out, just stick to the case. And then Grey's Anatomy became a hit, and that was very much in a story about people. So then we got the note, well, we'd like to have it more a story about people. It's the world of network television. Listen, we ran 6 years, which is a pretty good run for TV these days, and again, a bunch of nice people. And so it was overall a great experience, but it would have been interesting to see where the series had gone had Tim Kring been allowed to express his initial vision.
Gotcha. And so how was it like for you stepping behind the camera? I mean, do you have, doing that, does that, kind of get you excited about that? Is there a possible film from you coming down the road?
Yeah, I was very comfortable. I wasn't worried about it at all. I directed a ton of theater, and I worked with some of the best directors who'd ever lived, from Paul Verhoeven to David Lynch to, Tony Scott to John Badham to William Friedkin. It's a long list that I'm leaving out a lot of people. I was very anxious to steal from every single one of them. So I approached it with absolutely zero trepidation and great enthusiasm and loved every minute of it. It was funny. Originally they said, yeah, we're going to let you direct, but we have to write a script that you don't appear in. I said, why? I said, well, you can't direct yourself. And I said, what the hell you think I've been doing for the last 3 years?
Right.
You know, you guys think you've been directing me? You're absolutely wrong. And I said, and also, there have been a few notable exceptions to that, to your misconception. You know, and so eventually they began to believe me and trust me and allowed me to appear in more and more of the episodes which I directed, and that was really the most fun.
Gotcha. So a couple quick questions going in reverse a little bit. So, you know, basically growing up in an entertainment business family, you know, what are you like as a little kid?
What was I like as a little kid?
Right. What are you like growing up? Like, do you start off as a youngster? I want to be an actor when I grow up. Do you have, or you want to be like a fireman? You know, I'm just like, how do you start?
No, you know, to tell you the truth, I was really, really attracted by the music. I loved going to recording sessions with my mother. I loved music in general. I think I just adored music from the day I was born. It was really my first sort of creative obsession. But in terms of, you know, people say, oh boy, what was it like growing up with famous parents? And to tell you the truth, I had absolutely no sense of that whatsoever. You know, my parents had unusual jobs, but I didn't have a sense of the notion that they were special or famous or, you know, anything out of the ordinary. They went to work and they had jobs that they cared about, and they came home and had dinner and played with their kids, and any great talent in my parents until I was well into my teens. I mean, they said, oh, your mother's the greatest singer. I was like, really? She is? Okay. All right. If you say so. And I really wasn't aware of how truly gifted she was and how skilled she was at putting over a song until I'd say my mid to late teens. And I said, oh boy, she really is pretty good, you know? And I have to say, to a lesser degree, the same was true of my dad. It was easier to recognize in my dad because he would go away and become this person who was so different from the guy that I knew at home. And I recognized that as, you know, a particular skill. That to me was like, oh, okay, that looks like it's hard to do. Be somebody different and then come home and be dad. So I think I sort of appreciated my dad's work before I did my mother's.
Gotcha.
She just sort of got up there and sang, which is what she did at home. And what's so special about that?
Right. It's very normal. Yeah.
Yeah. Just what I grew up with.
Right. So, you know, with your dad's career and you following the path, is there something that you take from your dad? Like, do you learn something from your dad that's helped you throughout the course of your career?
Yeah, he had a real serious work ethic, and he took every job, big and small, incredibly seriously, and he treated people well. He never thought of himself as above anyone or more important than anyone, and he approached his work with great seriousness and great sense of humor. I know it sounds like a contradiction in terms, but it really isn't. And considered himself enormously fortunate to have the success that he did. And that is what he taught me by example.
That's awesome. Can you tell me a little bit, sorry, just having a microphone issue. can you tell me a little bit about some of the stuff that you're working on now? It looks like you've got a couple things in the hopper. Like one that looks really kind of up my alley called Faraway Eyes.
Oh, yeah. I don't know how that's going to turn out. I really don't. I think there were some good moments, and I'm just not too sure. But you know what? I've guessed wrong so many times, I've stopped guessing. It might be good. It might be less than good. I'm not so sure. All I can tell you is my best memory of it is Hong Kong. It was my first trip to Hong Kong, and I just fell in love with the city and had a great time. And I had a great time at work, too. It was a really nice cast. I just don't know how the picture's going to turn out. There's another one I did shortly thereafter called The Courier, which I think is going to be a pretty good movie.
And then,
well, I haven't.
Go ahead, Mike.
Go ahead. I was going to say, I haven't seen Hard Road to Hell yet. I know that's out on video, so I just added it to my queue. So I'm curious to see that one as well. Hard Ride to Hell. Hard Ride to Hell.
Oh, God. Fucking.
That good, huh?
Just please, just erase it from your queue. Horrible. Beyond horrible. That was the quintessential money gig. The worst movie I've ever been a part of. And again, I was talking about money gigs. You look up money gig, that movie is right there. Yeah, it was. I don't mind saying it's
nice.
It's a horrible, horrible, dreadful movie, and I really wish you wouldn't see it.
Can we quote you on that?
your opinion of me will change. Although I defy any actor alive to say those lines and make them any better than I did. it was just carnage every day. It was just awful. Really probably the worst thing I've ever done. And again, I did my best. I really did. I didn't walk in there saying, I'm going to do a shitty job because this is a terrible script. I really, really needed the money. I've got kids in boarding school and one in college and ex-wives with their hands out. And that came at a time where the money really would have come in handy. And I said yes without really giving the script a good long look. And I can honestly say that I regret it. And I don't care who hears me say that.
Nice. So do you look at yourself on IMDb every now and again?
Never.
No, because there's a list on here that someone put up called the Greatest Jerks List, which is actors that play the greatest jerks in film.
Yeah.
And you're on here, and you are number 16 out of 20. So what do you do? What do you have to do to get to number one is my question for you.
I don't know. I don't want to know. I have no idea. You know, there's something, and I don't know what it is. It's nothing I do consciously, but it seems that I really have no idea what it is, but I've really played some pretty despicable people. But strangely enough, they're despicable people that the audience likes. And I don't know why that is. I really don't. People would come up to me on the street or in a bar or in a restaurant and just say, God, you were such an asshole. I would love to have a beer with you. You know, they disliked me in a very benevolent fashion. And I don't know why. Again, it's nothing that I did consciously. Just, I guess I'm grateful to that, innate thing that just comes across, and I have no idea what it is.
Nice. I think that's all we have for you, Mike. Do you have anything else?
No, that's about it. Otherwise, I'll just keep gushing about Mr. Farrar's former role.
Please.
So I'll stop now.
So before we let you go, can we get you to record a show ID for us?
Sure, man.
All right. So basically, it's just you say your name, and then you say you're in the projection booth with Mike and Justin.
Okay. I'll give you a few of them. Ready? Ready?
Yep.
This is Miguel Ferrer, and you are in the projection booth with Mike and Justin. Here's another one. I'm Miguel Ferrer, and you're in the projection booth with Mike and Justin. Enjoy yourselves.
Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure.
All right, man. Good talking to you guys. I can't believe the level of homework. It's probably the most I've seen ever. So,
well, we didn't talk about Mr. Magoo, but if we leave that out.
One of these days.
There's funny stories about that one, too.
Save those for another day?
Yeah. No, they're actually pretty funny. Stanley Tong directed that.
Yeah.
Guy from China. And
Rumble in the Bronx.
Yeah, exactly. You're very connected to, what's the guy's name?
Jackie Chan.
Thank you, Jackie Chan. I told you, my mind is gone. But I think it was his first American picture, and we'd do a take, and he would call me over the monitor, and they'd replay it, and he'd say, "Okay, now here, that's very good acting right there. That's good acting, and now it's bad. It's very bad. It gets bad acting here, very bad. Now it gets good again. It's good. It's good. So let's do it again, but take out bad acting, okay?" And so he did that a lot, and it reduced a lot of the women to tears. I just thought it was really funny, but that was Mr. Magoo. Yeah,
awesome.
There was another time where I can't remember the name of the actress, and it wasn't Kelly Lynch, but not one of the other actresses. He dragged her into the makeup trailer and said to the makeup artist, he pointed to some lines on her forehead. He said, "See those lines? Make them go away. They're very ugly. Make those lines go away. So make her look bad. Those lines make her look very bad." And so the actress started crying and ran to her trailer. It's a big mess. Producer had to come in and say, "Listen, English isn't his first language. That's not what he meant." But Stanley is a trip, man.
Nothing like a good stereotype on a Monday night.
So that's my Mr. Magoo story. And I'll finally let you go. I'm keeping you on longer than you want me. I'll talk to you guys in the future, I hope.
Hey, yes,
absolutely.
And I'll get a hold of the lady who helped set this up, and I'll get your address so I can send you that L.A. Sheriff's Homicide.
You know what, man? That would be so cool, and I would really appreciate it. Thank you a lot.
Yeah, sure. No problem.
All right, guys. You take care.
You too. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Anything we should be working on?
Yeah. You might practice walking without dragging your knuckles on the floor.
Albert, let's talk about knuckles. The last time I knocked you down, I felt bad about it. The next time is going to be a real pleasure.
You listen to me. While I will admit to a certain cynicism, the fact is that I'm a naysayer and hatchet man in the fight against violence. I pride myself in taking a punch, and I'll gladly take another because I choose to live my life in the company of Gandhi and King. My concerns are global. I reject absolutely revenge, aggression, and retaliation. The foundation of such a method is love. I love you, Sheriff Truman.
Albert's path is a strange and difficult one.
If you enjoy this show and want more people to know about it, head on over to iTunes, leave a comment, and rate it 5 stars. Make sure you like and share us on Facebook, and don't forget to follow us on Twitter. Just search for Christopher Media. Thank you in advance for supporting Christopher Media by clicking on the PayPal button and by clicking through to all the sponsors who support ChristopherMedia.net. Most importantly, we would like to take the time to extend an extra special thanks to you. Christopher Media could not exist without your support. Thank you for visiting ChristopherMedia.net, and thank you for listening. Christopher Media. Let's make some noise.